From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco, Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto, my beloved.
Redwood City.
Coming up, we'll look back at a group of migrants who changed the face of Richmond.
My dad never told us that we were going to be living in boxcars. Well, I was a young child, so I didn't really, even if he mentioned it, you know, I don't remember.
We'll also hear the whispers of Chinese American history.
It's part of a kind of almost like a investigative journalism combined with a very epic poem.
And we'll meet the artists shaping Bay Area music today. Bay Area's cross-cultural evolution, today on Cross Currents. We'll start our cross-cultural journey today with a look at our past. Some of the first people in the Bay Area were Native Americans, members of the Ohlone tribe, who settled around what is now the city of Richmond. Beginning in the 1920s, another group of Native people found their way to the Bay Area. They were migrants from the Acoma and Laguna tribes of the Southwest. When they arrived, they took up an unusual living arrangement, in boxcars, parked on the dead ends of the city's railroad tracks. This year marks 3 decades since the last boxcar dwellers left their homes. Their experiences have been preserved by UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. KALW's Holly Kernan sat down with Sam Redman of the library's Regional Oral History Office to find out more about life on the rails.
In the late 1860s, of course, the Transcontinental was finally completed. But from there, these networks sort of continued on and continued building. And the Santa Fe Railroad in the early 1920s wanted to pass through two Pueblo villages, in particular the Laguna Pueblo and the Acoma Pueblo.
These are Native American villages.
Yes, that's right. And in order to do that, they had to reach a verbal agreement with some of the tribal elders that in exchange for the right to build the rail line through their villages, that they would be offered jobs working for the railroad. And the terminus for the rail line was in Richmond, California.
And so what happened? Why did they live in boxcars?
The idea was that they would stay on these temporary boxcars for a short period of time, and then eventually tract housing would be built for them near the same site in Richmond.
And is that what happened?
That's indeed what happened. But for quite some time, people did live in the boxcars, which were of course quite different from what they had grown up with. Not only by the fact that they were now living in a boxcar rather than a house that they had been living in New Mexico, but they also were surrounded by this massive growing industry situated right between Standard Oil and new rapidly growing war industries for World War II.
All right, so let's dip into our audio archives and hear from Bertha Hicks, whom you recently interviewed. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about Bertha.
Sure. Bertha Hicks, it was a great experience sitting down with her. She still lives in Richmond and still works at the National Park, the Rosie the Riveter World War II American Homefront National Park.
Okay, let's hear from Bertha Hicks.
My dad never told us that we were going to be living in boxcars. Well, I was a young child, so I didn't really, even if he mentioned it, you know, I don't remember. But I do recall that as soon as my mom and I got off the railroad, the train at the depot, it was foggy. And I'm not sure whether it was the early part of the year or towards the end of the year, because, you know, Richmond itself, we get a lot of fog. And so I remember getting off the train, and I didn't speak English. I spoke my language. And so my first question to my dad was, what is this? You know, where am I? And my dad says, well, he says, I'll explain everything. He says, right now, this is a fog. And I had no idea what fog was. And so I was kind of flabbergasted at that time. I didn't know what had happened.
That's Bertha Hicks, who moved from Santa Fe, New Mexico to Richmond, California, when her father came here to work on the railroad. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about Bay Area history with Sam Redman from the UC Berkeley Bancroft Library Audio Archives. And Sam, she says that they picked up their stuff, hopped aboard a train, and went to California. What kind of jobs did they get?
Well, it's interesting. In that era, railroads today are quite safe. We take that for granted. But in those eras, there were a few more rail accidents and things of that nature. And any time that would happen, you'd need laborers to straighten out the steel and fix the rail lines and general maintenance and things of that nature. They also needed people to paint rail cars. So they had a station where they could do labor like that and maintenance and upkeep on the rail line. But many of the stories that we have are from a child's perspective. And this is it's an interesting aspect to this because we're looking at a traditional reservation-based life versus coming into this rapidly industrializing world.
Yeah, and she seems to talk about kind of a culture shock, a culture clash.
And what's fascinating to me is that you're certainly seeing a culture shock, to be sure, but you're also seeing something that's defined by just the environment that people had been raised in and the opportunities that they'd had before them. And here's this, in some sense, a new opportunity during the midst of the Great Depression when times are toughest and especially hard on the reservations where there are so few opportunities to have a decision presented to you as a family, as Bertha's father came out for this job opportunity and then eventually brought his family. That was the case with many of these inhabitants of the boxcar village. There were probably between 20 to 30 single families at any one time living in these boxcars. But then there were also some single men as laborers as well.
And Sam, we've got more recordings to play, right?
That's right. We can get a better understanding of what village life was like from Emily DeCorey, who was interviewed by a colleague of mine named Elizabeth Castle.
The Acoma people were living on the south side, and the Laguna people were living on the north side. And our homes were different colors. I remember the Acoma people had red homes.
Oh, really?
Painted red, kind of like, not really bright red, but kind of burgundy. And our homes were painted like gray, kind of like It was, our homes were different colors. But we lived in the north side, on the north side, but the whole village was like connected. There was no gap in between. There were no fences, to separate the homes. It was just all one village. That's the way we were set up. And the Acoma people and the Laguna people got along very well.
That's Emily DeCorey, a member of the Laguna Nation, and she was speaking with Elizabeth Castle from the UC Berkeley Oral History Archives at the Bancroft Library. And I'm joined today by Sam Redman from the Bancroft. Sam, how long did this boxcar village of Richmond last?
The verbal agreement was reached in 1922, and the village really grew through the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And then life really did change following World War II for Native Americans. In the 1950s, there was a lot of renewed tribal activism. In the 1960s and 70s, mirroring the civil rights movement and then the Black Power movement, Native Americans really got going a Red Power movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And the American Indian movement that would come to define later Native American life. But during this time, a lot of people were also just moving back to reservations. The Santa Fe Railroad chose to shut off power to the village in 1982.
People were still living there in 1982?
A number of people were still living there in 1982, yes.
And so when they shut off the power, that was the end of
this? That was that. So you still have a few little remnants of the village and certainly individuals that still live in the Bay Area that grew up here. But mostly it's a memory. And that's the great thing about oral history is that, in order to really have access to this, not everything was written down. Not everything was photographed. And sometimes you have to go and learn from actually talking to people who were there and lived and experienced this firsthand.
That was Sam Redman of UC Berkeley's Regional Oral History Office. He spoke with KALW's Holly Kernan. Do you have memories of Boxcar Village? Tell us your story at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We might share your story on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Decades before the boxcar dwellers arrived in California, the gold rush brought another group of settlers westward from across the United States.
Open up that golden gate, California, here I come.
At the same time, another migration was flowing eastward. Over three decades, the country's Chinese population grew from 4,000 to more than 100,000. The immigrants who landed on California's shores followed the Transcontinental Railroad across the state, building pockets of community along the way. 150 years later, artist Rennie Young is developing a theater production based on the stories passed on from that time. She's traveling along the Transcontinental Railroad, and at each point along the way, she's sharing the tales she's gathered from that region, on stage. She calls the project Chinese Whispers. It's actually another name for the game of telephone, which is all about how stories change from teller to teller.
It is the implicit, unspoken underside of history that I'm interested in. These kinds of forgotten pieces.
Young's Bay Area performance is called Chinese Whispers, Golden Gate. KALW's Erica Mu attended a workshop performance in San Francisco.
It's a brisk Sunday afternoon at Hyde Street Pier in San Francisco. Just past the edge of the dock, an old paddle steamboat called the Eureka bobs in the shallow water. People slowly make their way up the gangplank.
Are you here for the Chinese Whispers?
Yeah, how'd you know that?
Yeah. Guessing, a lot of people. Come run on board? Yes.
Okay, thanks.
At the time, Chinese were not allowed to be buried along with whites, so they had to have their own little cemeteries outside of town.
Rennie Young is the artistic and project director of Chinese Whispers. Her project has taken her all over the state, starting with the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, where, she says, the ghosts of the past have left many questions for the present.
So this young girl was taken to somewhere near a Chinese cemetery, and she remembered seeing the queues of the Chinese hanging in the trees.
A queue is a long braid traditionally worn by Chinese men.
What does that mean?
I have no idea. I have never read about this anywhere. And did it mean that it was a sign of honoring? That the queue was important then and that you don't bury it? Was it that they saved it to sell? I have no idea.
The stories she's gathering center on the way Chinese immigrants survived in 19th century America. Some operated restaurants and grocery, hardware, and herbal stores in San Francisco. Others made and sold fish fertilizer. Shrimp fishing was huge, and a few enterprising individuals had side projects as well.
He had a restaurant in town. In fact, one of the buildings on the main street of Luck he built as his Chinese restaurant. And that is now Al the Wops, which is right next to the Zhen Yun Tong Hall. Therefore, right next door to his two illicit operations.
Kevin Lee is one of the storytellers on stage in today's workshop performance. He isn't telling the story of his own heritage. He's actually reading the words of Jeff Lee. Jeff Lee grew up in the city of Lock, and he now works in Santa Rosa. His family immigrated to the Bay Area in 1892. Kevin Lee's family has been in Oakland for 40 years. Offstage, he says that the story of the early Chinese in America is skeletal at best.
Going through the American school system, the only thing I knew was that the Chinese came over in waves, and that's it. But nothing's actually written been shared about what they the real historical piece of it, what their lives were like, how they felt, what they confronted.
How did they survive? How did they thrive? How did they not survive?
These are the questions that preoccupy Rennie Young.
It's part of almost like a investigative journalism combined with a very epic poem.
Young says that the common thread weaving many Bay Area stories together is the Chinese Exclusion Act. Passed in 1882, it was the first of many laws aimed at ending Chinese immigration completely.
Whereas, in the opinion of the government of the United States, the coming of Chinese laborers to this country endangers the good order of certain localities within the territory thereof.
People would tell me in their story, well, because of the Exclusion Act, he had to do this, or he couldn't do that about an ancestor. Or because of the Exclusion Act, they lost their family, their family business.
The law split many families on either side of the Pacific. Some purchased false papers to enter the U.S. Over time, those fake identities became their real ones. And those fluid transitions further complicated family histories.
My name is Ford Lee, but let me tell you that's not my real family name. My family name is Lim or Lum.
Ford Lee is another one of the workshop storytellers. He's the only one telling his own family story.
My father came over on false papers, merchant papers my grandfather bought for him. So he came over as Lee Ho, that's why I'm Lee.
Many descendants like Lee only know bits and pieces of their family histories.
Actually, there are a lot of things I don't know about my family, and I wish that I had time to, now that I think about it, ask my mother, ask my father.
Even if he did ask, he may not have received an answer. Often, Chinese parents didn't want to share painful memories with their children. Other stories from that time period were lost because men who couldn't bring their families over had no one to pass them on to. Again, Rennie Young.
I believe the absences speak volumes and are much more powerful about telling the story of organized social amnesia than any single statement could make.
She said.
Chinese Whispers Golden Gate is a practice in recognizing the value and pitfalls of a cultural story made up almost entirely of hearsay. Each tale is fragmentary. Voices come and go. Some stories are started and never finished. But each time a new person hears these stories, they all stay alive just a little longer. In San Francisco, I'm Erica Mu for Cross Currents.
The music you heard in this story was composed by Jeremiah Moore. Rennie Young is still gathering stories for Chinese Whispers Golden Gate. If you have a story or know of someone who does, you can share them on Chinese-Whispers.org. They might be a part of a final Chinese Whispers performance at the end of the year. You can find more information on our website, KALW.org. It's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Now let's check in on today's Bay Area music scene. Youth Radio's Brandon McFarland hosts the streaming radio station AllDayPlay.fm. He joined me in studio to talk about his favorite up-and-coming artists.
Well, right now, something that's really big on YouTube is this female rapper by the name of The Bobby Effect, and she basically has put out a string of freestyle videos where she's freestyling over the popular hip-hop songs. And a few in particular have gotten in the thousands, almost 170,000 views to be exact. And she's basically putting her hat in the ring amongst a lot of new female rappers, a lot of in-your-face. She's got an in-your-face style reminiscent of a Nicki Minaj and a few newer artists like Iggy Azalea from Australia and Azalea Banks, who's from Harlem. So she's definitely something that I'm looking at. I'm looking forward to hearing original music from her.
Do you think that the hype around the Bobby Effect is warranted?
Time will tell. Freestyle videos can wear really thin really quickly. There's not much replay value in those for me, but she definitely looks the part. She's got the thrift store hipster look, and she's rapping pretty well. So original music is what I'm waiting to hear. But until then, we don't know.
So you mentioned that she has 170,000 hits on YouTube. How accurate a measure would you say YouTube is for checking out how popular an artist is?
Well, the views aren't as important as the comments and the likes. If nobody's liking it and everybody's viewing it, then it's probably just getting, you know, one click and then you're passing on. But her likes were in the hundreds, so it might be legit.
And I see that some artists like Rihanna or Adele, they get hits on YouTube in the like 170 million kinds of numbers.
Yeah, and those are big pop stars with, you know, major labels backing them. When it comes to being completely independent and just showing up, 100,000 is a nice marker to make your debut on YouTube.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to a little bit of the Bobby Effect. This is her song, Bunny Montana.
Glitter in my choppy, bunny, bunny rap, hip-hopping. Clean up these weak, you say I am whopping. I've lost all control, you reek rappers gotta go. I spit in an accent, round, I'm still cold. My flow's so spasmatic, now you Bobby Attics. Bobby Effect books you in, you're still stuck in traffic. My music makes you go, you love my I smoke tree, it lifts me, you know my eyes real low.
That's Bunny Montana from the Bay Area rapper The Bobby Effect. So she's going off there in a little fake UK accent, a little fake English accent. But let's turn to somebody who has a real English accent, because you've been following a DJ out of the UK. Tell me about it, Brandon.
Yeah, yeah. His name is Davey Boy Smith, and he actually runs a blog based out of the UK called Southern Hospitality. And they specialize in Bay Area music and music from down south. But they're big fans of Bay Area hip-hop. I talked to him briefly about where his affinity started with Bay Area music. He said it started with Mac Dre, the late Mac Dre, and Thiz Nation Records. And he was just a big fan, and he would play it out in clubs around London. And ever since then, he's just been a fan of everything Bay Area that was new and exciting. And now he's able to come to the States and host an all Bay Area showcase at South by Southwest this year.
So it's about the Bay Area making waves across the pond. Let's go ahead and listen to a little bit of that blast from the past with Mac Dre.
I'm out of this world, not your run of the millin'. My name is Fur, I'm the owner of the building. I'm a stoner and I'm chilling with you like Jack. I pimped and I mag, drive a Benz on a lack. Man, I've been in the back with the groupies and the stars. I've been out front with the thugs and the cars. I've been on the yard with the Mexican mafia. And I only run with that are killing Dafia.
That's the late Vallejo rapper Mac Dre. And we are talking with Brandon McFarlane from alldayplay.fm. Let's turn now to a little bit of the funk scene. This is the electro-funk band B Bravo from San Francisco. Tell me a little bit about B Bravo, Brandon.
B Bravo is a DJ out of San Francisco, California. I remember a few years back, he was accepted into Red Bull Academy. And since then, he's put out an EP called Kiss and Tell with his band. And it's basically, yeah, very funky electro, almost late 80s themed, like, funk music. So it's really exciting. It's really refreshing to hear. We haven't heard this type of musicianship in a long time in the Bay Area.
Let's listen to this for a second. This is B Bravo and the Starship Connection. That sounds pretty polished. Does that have a possible national following, do you think, Brandon?
I definitely think so. It's very exciting to see live. You just see maybe like five keyboards, and they're all just, you know, going on at once. So it's really exciting to see live, and I think they could take that show, oh man, across the world.
Well, B Bravo and the Starship Connection is going to be playing at South by Southwest. They are another Bay Area link to that great festival in Austin. And Brandon, can you tell me a little bit about what's most popular right now on All Day Play? What's new there?
Well, the most popular thing to date is the very first pilot episode for Thizzler Radio. And Thizzler.com is another blog that specializes in Bay Area music. It's based out of the Bay Area, run by blogger by the name of M. Dubious, and he's been premiering new artists for the past 2 or 3 years. one of the newest artists that he's championing. His name is Armani DuPaul, and he's a pretty good artist out of Oakland, California. It's definitely a long list of artists coming out of Oakland, but Thizzler is definitely backing this guy.
As we proceed to give you what you need.
That's Thizzler.com. You can hear that at alldayplay.fm. We've been talking with Brandon McFarlane. He's the editor of Youth Radio streaming radio station. Again, that's alldayplay.fm. Find links to everything we talked about and more Youth Radio work at turnstilenews.com. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Chris Hoff, Artyom Skonohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Nina Nicole, Rena Palta, and Alexander Victoria. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Carshare, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll consider the art and science of designing good signs.
Oh, I go that way to catch BART. Oh, I go that way to catch Muni. Oh.
That and more tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The song you're hearing is by folk rock musician Brian Bergeron of San Francisco. Perhaps you've heard his music on TV. It's appeared on programs ranging from The Voice on NBC to Keeping Up with the Kardashians on the E! Network. He's going to be playing his first show with a full band on Friday at Hotel Utah in San Francisco. Music begins about 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. I'll take